Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Yo, yo, what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cuff. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond.
What's up with it, y'all? Man, don't change that sound. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that sound. Wiggling.
Yeah, this is Cassidy, the hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, mom. Easy.
Keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cut Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cuff, baby.
What's up, everybody? This your girl, Bonnie Dollars, the queen of trap, representing Crenshaw, and you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up,
y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout-out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio, and I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
Hey, what it ain't, what it do. Chilly Chill from that original Lynch Mob. Off the Cuff Radio, always where it's at on Friday night. West, y'all.
And you are now tuned in to episode 562 of Off the Cuff Radio. I'm your host, King Eric the Media Assassin. And this show is sponsored by Buddy Boy Entertainment, Da Vinci Clothing, Screwball Radio. And I got my partner, T-Max with the Facts on the Line. What's good?
What's going on? What's going on, brother? It's another Super Sunday on OTC. And we, of course, got another fire show ready for you in terms of setting it up for this week. Got a very, very legendary guest tonight. This individual has been holding it down for Stockton, California for years. And he is founder of the legendary Doja Click. Excuse me, y'all, just to clear my throat. And he's representing all of it. I mean, Brookside, Spanos, Stonewood, Lincoln Village, Proper Pacific, Western Ranch, Lincoln Village, West Lakeview, all of it. Doing it just fine for that 209. Dropping his first debut album way back today, Underground Mail Road. He's one of the most prolific, one of the most celebrity status, one of the Stockton originals. And we are so blessed and humbled on Off the Cuff Radio to have him with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, representing it, Ren the Heat Monster. What it do, man?
What's good,
yes,
brother?
Sir. What's going on, y'all?
What's going happy on to have you on, man. Happy to have you on. We had that little delay last week. I'm glad Blog Talk finally got the issue solved. So now we at it, man. Welcome to 562 of Off the Cuff Radio, brother.
Yes, sir. We here.
Absolutely. Ren, I mean, reading your history was we were researching. Your biography, your discography is a who's who. Working with some of the most famous in the industry, with you being famous in the industry, you're definitely putting it on for your part of Northern California. I mean, you got a long, long history, and we got a little bit of time to get through that history in very intricate, intimate, specific, and full detail tonight. As I say, like we do about this time, tell everybody a little bit about yourself and how you got started, and we got a lot to get to, so let's get it.
Okay, shit. I started in 91. I didn't drop until like 94, 95, but we started the group in 91, but it wasn't Doja Click at first. It was TXG, Triple X Gangsta.
Gotcha.
But that name was too. Everybody had like a Triple X or this and that. So I was like, man, that was too common. So I gathered up the fellas. I was like, shit, we all smoked Doja, and we all clicked up. Let's just call it Doja Click, and that'll stick.
Mm-hmm. Now, pretty much, when you think about that time in the 90s, of course, you all in Northern California, as we talked off air, but there is a bit of a difference between, you know, the Bay, what is considered the Bay Area, and where you were all at in Stockton.
Yeah.
You know, in earnest, for the Bay Area, really Northern California, Uncle Short, you know, Shout Too Short, you know, he's the one that really put it on for Northern California and will lay down the foundation,
yes,
you know, for Mac Dre, you know, rest in peace, of course, E-40 and Richie Rich, who are considered, you know, the four godfathers of Mount Rushmore for, you know, Bay Area rap is the original.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously you all were following, you know, those footsteps of it out there. How did that Bay Area rap scene really, really influence you all in terms of really honing your sound and really deciding what direction you all wanted to go with music?
They came in the scene. I was already in the hip hop from like 1984, Run DMC. So I've been in hip hop
mm-hmm.
since 84. I grew up
mm-hmm.
listening to East Coast artists like Big Daddy Kane, LL Cool J. You know, Cool
mm-hmm.
G Rap, and they had gas then. People don't think, you go back and listen to the Roads of the Riches and Big Daddy Kane,
yeah.
Smooth Operator, he was gassing. They were gassing.
Mm-hmm.
But then Ice King came out, and that was the first time I ever heard some West Coast gangsta shit, because before that it was like L.A. Dream Team, Egyptian Lovers, they were like techno dance music.
Right.
And then when Too Short came out, that changed it up, because that was our regional sound. Even though we ain't from the Bay, that's our cousins. We right around the corner. So Too Short
mm-hmm.
came out, you know, in N.W.A., you know what I mean? The West Coast sound, that's what really started, you know, I started paying attention. But I didn't get into the game until like 94, 95. We didn't release till 95. And that's the independent Bay Area game taught me how to push records. And that's where everything just hit us quick, because we didn't understand it at first. We were just having fun doing it as a hobby. It became serious when the money started just piling in.
Mm-hmm. Now,
mm-hmm.
and that
now,
was part
now
of
one
the
thing
education
about
too.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was saying that's a part of the, you guys coming from a different part of the epicenter of hip hop, the opposite epicenter. It's like you guys had to learn to hustle and trade a different way, because, you know, this was back around the time where you had to try to get signed, put your demo out there. You guys had to learn from the grid,
yeah.
like how to hustle those records.
Yeah, there wasn't no internet then, so we had to get on our feet and you know, hit the streets with it. And back then, like the A&Rs was coming to the hood looking for talent, so that's how we had to approach the game. You know what I mean? We was like, shit, they might be looking,
mm-hmm.
so let's push these units, because they was looking at independent artists, because the independent artists in the north was running shit, because we figured out something that no one else, you know, that they didn't know. Now you see a lot of people doing the independent route, but back then it was a whole different. Before the internet, we were killing them in the independent game.
Now, one thing about it, Ren, there's one name that is synonymous. He is considered one of the fathers of, you know, looking after, you know, his offspring in terms of the business aspect. Shout out to Uncle St. Charles, you know, in terms
oh, yeah.
of how he was really giving game. And, of course, you know, Stockton, Richmond, you know, of course, Richmond, California. There
mm-hmm.
was some guy, you know, transplant from New Orleans, you know, had a tank for, you know, a mascot. I think you know what I'm talking about. You know, some guy named Master P. I think you heard of him.
Yep.
So he was out there, you know, with his record store a lot of, you know, back in the day. Now, when you look at it, because this is in the 80s and 90s, so
yeah.
like you said earlier, we didn't have the internet like we did. The videos are what we saw. You know, and even then, we didn't know that, you know, Stockton is like, it's real out there. I mean, when you got a place like the Southwest Side, Central West, you know, the UOP, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, where did you grow up at, and what did you experience from the street side in terms of what you saw growing up out there?
Well, I'm from the east side, Stockton, Stribley Park, Sosa, and growing up there, it was right when the Crips and Bloods hit the drugs and all that, selling dope, crack, everything hit the scene, hit our scene the same way. And I had a lot of friends that passed away young, you know what I mean, like young kids that weren't even 20 years old yet, dying, getting robbed, you know what I mean, and pushing. So I think whatever hood, the worst hood in America seen, I seen it, because Stockton was just the same from the late 80s to the, even my brother, my older brother, he seen it, you know, shit, he was in some shit before I even seen anything. For I was a little 10-year-old, you know what I mean? He was a little older than me, so he was already seeing shit before I did, you know what I mean? So it's pretty bad there, but shit, there's some good stuff too. Because when hip-hop came out, it seemed like everybody was, you know, connecting with each other. It's just after that, it went bad when, you know, crack hit the corner, changed the whole neighborhood.
Yeah, and it was pretty much... Yeah, and I think that's pretty much what it also, too, Ren, I think it also gave authenticity to the music, because from every region, you know, whether you're from New Orleans, whether you're from L.A.,
yeah,
whether you're from Brooklyn, Bronx, Miami, Atlanta, Houston.
Crack game, Brooklyn, the rap game.
Yeah, man.
Basically, yeah. It's reality, you know. It's reality rap.
How important was it for you all in terms of when you all clicked up and really started going with this to really make a name? Because like you said, once y'all really got on the gas and started, you know, moving with no brakes, you know, straight, you know, ignoring the fakes and pushing, how important was it for y'all to really, really, really be able to put your city on the map and really give y'all experiences during that time?
See, back then was word of mouth, and I think it traveled pretty far to the Bay Area. And I started networking. I went to the Gavin back then when they used to have the seminars. But how it just started moving, it just happened. I don't know. Like I said, we did it for fun and just be like, let's do a rap album. You know what I mean? Shit, let's press them up or whatever. And then it just, from there, we started getting calls and people started hitting us, radio stations and the Low Rider Super Show Tour, and got investors hitting us. You know, we started getting put in magazines and, getting, you know, it started taking us to another level of the game that we didn't, you know about. And next thing you know, we're on fucking tours and shit. And it just started blowing up. It's just weird because word of mouth is a motherfucker.
It is.
Hey, you guys.
And it was less rappers back then.
Right. You know, King and myself, we're huge fans of the Bay. And, you know, looking at when you all came in, you all were coming along with what was, some would say was that second Bay Area movement. Because by this time in the early 90s, you know, this is when E-40 was Stick With It. You know, Spice One had just gotten on. That's Northern California rap in general. Of course, Andre Nicotina, a.k.a. Dre Dawg, you know, was coming in. You know, later on we would have Mac Maul, you know, Young Lay, Ray Love, Conscious Daughters, shout out CMG, rest in peace, Special One, you know, so Paris the Black Panther. So you all were really, really putting on for Northern California at the time. What did you learn at that time, Ren, about the business aspects in terms of when you said, you know, you all started getting attention and a lot of people were coming y'all way with these offers and you all, because this is before, as we said, social media. So this is like you said, you had to be good at this. What did you learn about the business aspect of the time, collectively?
I didn't learn it until we started off in 95. But I guess you could say I learned it in 95, but I didn't get real into it, like the publishing, until like 97, Speed Kills. At 95, I pressed the CDs up along with the help of my boy Nano. And then I learned about, you know, like you said, St. Charles. I wrote him a letter on one of my flyers, and he wrote back to me. So he taught me something in that letter. And then I learned about distribution companies, you know what I mean? So I ended up hooking up with Walter Zelnick from City Hall Records out of San Rafael. Dropped him off a couple of boxes of CDs. I think it was like 200 at first. They start you small. They're like, let's see what you can do, you know what I mean? And from there on, they started ordering thousands right after that. And that's when I started learning, like, you know what? There's some good money in this, because we were getting $7 a CD. And they were selling them for $13 or $14. So to get $7 a CD compared to how it is now with the stream, see, man, I wish the young artists could have experienced that old school, them old school checks.
Especially where y'all was doing it then, $7 a CD, that was like, if you was on a major and you got a dollar a CD, you would consider like Prince or Michael Jackson or Whitney Houston.
Yeah.
So y'all flipped the game to where y'all was getting that hand over fist.
If you do the math, 1,000 CDs times $7.
Yeah. That's $7,000.
You know what I mean? And that was easy back then. That was easy. 1,000 CDs wasn't shit. We were selling 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 CDs per album.
Man.
Are we talking 90s money? Are we talking 90s money, y'all?
90s money. And I'm still spending 90s money because my old album still sells. So it's still coming.
Man,
you dig? Real course, spill.
Man, look, also real spill on the ill wisdom, man, because we would be remiss also, too, to not mention, of course, Aunt Banks. And, of course, shout out Black C, you know, from Ruthless by Law Posse, representing San Francisco as well. In his book, he talked about how they were moving in terms of the independent press. When you look at it in terms of going full, you know, pressing up, you know, and just run the full play, you know, getting them tossed out, you know, and everybody catching, you know, your wave and everything. How was it to really do the tours and everything, to do the shows? Because one thing that is synonymous with it, Ren, is that we noticed that to get your buzz back then, it was a lot more organic, and it really was a lot of footwork. Tell us what it was like going to those different spots and just really meeting the people and really interacting with your fans.
It was the biggest trip out to me was people singing our songs while we was on stage, and it was a big crowd. That's the first time I've seen some shit like that where I'm rapping my song, and you could read their lips rapping your song, and I'm like, damn, we in different regions, and they know our songs. It felt like probably like how NWA did when they first came out and they was going to different cities. It was the same kind of feeling, not as big, but the same kind of, because they was first to do it, you know what I mean?
Right.
But it was the same kind of feeling to see some shit like that, and you're on tour and you're with your homies, and it felt like, it didn't even feel like a tour because we was young and I was with the homies. We was just kicking it like we was kicking it, like always kicked it. We were just laughing and having fun and it going shopping, and it was, I can't wait to do a documentary.
Nigga, we waited on a documentary.
We waited on it, man.
Yeah.
Put that bad boy.
Look, we already going to have you back for part two, so we got to have you back for part two when, you know, the documentary is released.
See, Netflix got to cut a big check,
there
though, man. Like, even though they're going through that writer's strike shit, they got to cut a big check.
You know it.
Thinking about that time, Ren, and what you just said about streaming, what do artists have to understand today in terms of, and once again, I'm going to say this for the 20 millionth time, shout out Brother Khan, the Don we had on a couple years ago, because he broke down the mathematics. The full show is on YouTube, y'all. And he broke down the science of the streaming. Me and my brother, you know, we still talk about this today. You know, King and me are still amazed at how much thought, you know, Brother Khan broke this down to the very last micro penny of how much artists don't make streaming. Now, you all were getting $7 a record back then. And this is before all of that. How do you feel about music going digital now? And how important is it of the physical copies of records still being available to the listening public?
Well, I still make more money off the CDs repressing them than I do the streaming, because the streaming is nothing. It's like, and it could be manipulated. We don't even know. You know, I mean, a lot of people pay to get on a playlist. And this is, if streaming fools the average listener, and it fools the artists themselves, because it makes everyone think they're doing something when they're not. And it makes them try less harder to do things. You know what I mean? There's like, oh, I'm satisfied. I got a million streams. A million streams is really like probably less than 1,000 people listen to your shit over and over and over. The good part about it is you got a cult following listen to you over and over and over, but it ain't a million people. They see that million and it throws them off, and then next thing you know, they're like, I'm good with that. And they don't try even as hard to, or they even cheat the game. Just like you pay for streams, you pay for the verify check back then, and now they're really letting you pay for it. But it's just the digital game is just, you can't win. There's got to be like Snoop said, there's got to be a way to get around that shit, because, and even when Prince was alive, he said, how do you audit that shit? It could be manipulated so many times you can't even audit it.
Man, rest in peace.
It's a big difference. I sold over 100,000 CDs, so that was 100,000 people going into the store.
Right.
To buy your shit.
Man,
you don't even know if they like the song on the stream. You don't know if they like it. They could have listened to half of it and went to the next song. That don't mean just because you got that listen that they like you. You don't even know that. That's another
thing.
Right.
You know what's wild too is exposing. He didn't doing that type of stuff is exposing what their true draw is, because you see now they can't even sell out no shows.
Exactly. It doesn't transform to some of the social media. There's some people with like 300 followers and they got 200,000 streams, and they're like, yeah, I got 200, but they don't realize that ain't even less than the few hundred CDs sold.
Hmm. And that's a great follow up in terms
of the wisdom. I would be upset over them numbers. I was like, that ain't shit. That ain't that many CDs sold. You know what I mean? You ain't looking at it that way. They're looking at it like they think that's how many fans they got, but that's not. It's just a click of a button. They probably fast forward that shit. I'm being real though.
But you know though, Ren, and it's crazy because you're a veteran in this shit, you know, a distinguished one with really over 45 years in terms of you being a fan, you know, over 40 years being a fan and an artist. So you understand how the art is articulated in a fashion of where you really, the blood, the sweat, the tears, the perseverance, sleepless nights, the hustle, the heart, and the confidence of knowing you got some dope shit. I mean, when did you all realize with your music, when did you all realize at the time, you know, with Doja Click, that you all were really beginning to make some noise? Tell us about those early years when you really, really all started to really get out there in terms of you knew you really had something.
Well, shoot, I went to a house party once. This is before we were like, our name was cracking. We had just started. Probably the album wasn't even out a couple of months, maybe 3 months. I go to a house party. They didn't even know I was there. Next thing you know, they're playing my music, and the whole party was, you know, gigging to it. And then somebody said, he's here at the party. And, you know, after that, it was hearing myself at drive-thrus, you know what I mean? And I'm like going to McDonald's. Then I hear myself. You can see it grow like that. That part of the game before, you know, we started selling 10,000 CDs, the beginning part, watching it grow was magical to me. You know what I mean? That was like something that you didn't expect, and you start to see it grow in front of your eyes, and next thing you know, you somebody and shit. And back then, there wasn't that many rappers, so you would go to somebody's house, and they'd be like, that's the rapper. He's here. not my cousins rapping. I got a nephew and my uncle got an album out. You know what I mean? It was just a little different. So I would say the beginning of the career was just the start of it is something to see when you're an independent artist. And there wasn't that many rappers back then. You know what I mean? Now it's just you become a rapper and it's like kind of, I don't know. If I was out now, I'd be embarrassed a little bit to being called one.
Hard on the ground. Yeah, they set the bar pretty low because look at the competition now. See, the competition isn't really your peer. The competition is more so TikTok numbers. It's Twitter numbers now. And it's not peer-to-peer.
Yeah, that's what they're relying on. Yeah, it's just a whole different game. It's like you said, TikTok fame, TikTok rappers, Uber rappers doing stuff like that. I can't imagine Ice Cube doing stupid shit like that to get famous. You know what I mean?
Man, now your group's debut album, Hard on the Grind, and that is a seminal classic. Definitely set the tone. Now, one thing about it, we got to give our listeners a little bit of historical context in terms of how big this record was in terms of the records that were released in 1995. Shout out to the hip hop gods in this 50th year of us being children of the culture that we love so much. 1995, for all of you, out there, if you're a true head, you know what 1995 means in terms of music, hip hop and R&B. We had a litany of some of the greatest albums ever released in hip hop that year. Genius's Liquid Swords from Wu-Tang, Raekwon's Cuban Links, Faith Evans dropping her debut, King, and I know I'll probably get flamed in the comments because I may have gotten this shit wrong. I believe Federal with E-40, was that 95, I believe? Was that 90? No, In a Major Way. In a Major Way. I'm thinking of In a Major Way.
Yeah, that came out 93.
Okay, 93. Okay, 93. Thank you. But you figure in 1995, this is where we had, matter of fact, Old Dirty Bastard, rest in peace, his debut came out in 95. You all, because you only get 1 year when it's released in terms of what that number is because it never comes back around. How does it feel that you all dropped a classic album among your rap peers in such an important year? I mean, you all are part of history with this, man. How does it feel?
Man, I see it when I go on eBay and just search my name. That album sold for even $500 on eBay. I mean, it's 95. Shit, I don't know. It was magic that year because that's when we got our distribution deal, and I ended up with fans in Germany, Japan. This was before social media. All rappers now they go on their little thing. They be like, I got fans in Germany, you know, because Spotify plays their shit everywhere. So you ain't got a fan in Germany. You got somebody that streamed your shit. He might be a fan though, but before all that internet shit, we was already in Canada. I was getting real mail in the mail, fan mail, not emails. Emails came after that, but it was fan mail. It was just, I don't know. It was a good year. I look at it like this. I've been rapping since Pac and Biggie had albums out.
Yeah, matter of fact, 1995, Pop Me Against the World was dropped. You know, I mean,
see?
It was... Dog Food, you know, from Dog Pound was released in 95. I mean, we're probably going to come up with more random albums during this conversation.
Yeah, man, because the motive was different. The difference was you were listening to these songs and you was like, damn, how could I get this verse talking about how Big said this shit or how Nas said this?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But Nas made people literally rewrite their whole verses or rewrite their whole albums on how they approach certain songs.
Yeah, that's real.
It's something to imagine. because we were youngins at the time. So the air was just different back then in terms of how music was marketed. I mean, shout out to Rap City, your MTV Rap Video Music Box. There is just so much that came out during that time. I mean, Master P, once again, we're going to keep randomly dropping records. The True album was released in 1995, you know, their debut group album, you know. So, I mean, this is just literally 1995 was just a nonstop heat rock of just hits that were kept coming. When you talk about your album, Rent, and you talk about how much it sold on eBay, because on Off the Cuff, we just throw out random trivia because we love our listeners and we want to give as much history as we can during the conversation. When you look at the, when you said how much it's going for, it made me also think of the clicks, E-40. We're going to get later on to that about how you hooked up with Sugar T. Shout out to her. We interviewed her as well a couple of years back. Shout out to Kemp. You know, shout out to Eric Schroeder, you know, for hooking that up for us. The Click album, a lot of people don't know this, because the original Click album before E-40 got their deal with Jive, the Click, there are two versions of this. If you're a real hip-hop fan, you know that there are two versions of that album. And the one that you get on Jive, and the one that's on Jive Records is the one that was nationally released. And then there's the one that was locally released in the Bay that is worth a shitload of money if you can find it. What was it? How do you pretty much still have any of those originals that you haven't stocked yourself of, Ren, or pretty much those were all moved over a course of time for the time you did all you all did release it?
I might have one CD in from then wrapped up somewhere.
World.
I wish. I got a Speed Kills, and I got one of Speed Kills, and I got one from Hard on the Grind somewhere, and it's probably in a drawer somewhere. It's one of the originals, but that's been repressed like five times, maybe six.
Now, in terms of the original going for 500, to give us some history, was there any difference between the very first original you all did that was pressed and the subsequent represses of it? What makes the original one such a collector's item?
Because everyone knows it didn't have a barcode on the back, and the CD was red and black.
Gotcha.
That's how everybody knows it's the first one. The second one that we pressed was from Indoja Records. That's after we put out Speed Kills, and shit, we was running out of Hard on the Grind, so we had to repress it. And the dude who put out Speed Kills, I came up with the name, the record company, Indoja Records, like Indo and Doja together, and he kept the name. I let him have the name basically, and he was the executive producer, so he repressed it and he put it, the logo on it, and that one has the Indoja Records logo, and the CD's not red anymore, so people know the difference with those first two.
Yes, sir. Now, in a perfect segue, Ren and King, because this is part of the second wave of that Northern California rap scene, because this is where you got San Quan, Gucci, JT, the bigger figure, and of course Sugar T is up there too. So tell us about Speed Kills. Well, before we get into that, when you did Hard on the Grind, tell us about what it was like in those studio sessions and what it was like when you all got into it in terms of when it was actually time to do the album. What was that like when you all knew that this was go time?
It was basically a me thing. Doja Click became Doja Click because I basically didn't want to do a solo. I wanted to come in with a couple of people. Because if you think about it, I'm on every song, and Wizard's only on one song. Little Man's on two songs. And that's it. I just put him on the cover, and I made a group out of it. But once it became a group, Speed Kills, I put, you know, I changed it up a little bit, and Peabody came in the scene, and Nasty Trey's already been down with us, but I put him on the cover and I made it a black and brown thing. So, but when I did the first album, it was on a four track, That's what I'm saying. We were just messing around, and it sounded good that someone came to me with money, you know, like the Eazy-E thing, basically. A motherfucker like Eazy-E, you know, you can get it from that part. So he was trying to take his money somewhere else, and he was like, man, that's not like some click E-40 shit, you know what I mean? That them beats was like, Bob, you know, and he came at me with, like, let's put it out. How much is it going to cost to put it out? I want to put my money investing in something. So that's where that happened. I basically did all the songs. I did it on a 4-track. You only have 4 tracks, so I put the beat on, like, stereo left and right, and we had 2 tracks to work with on our voice. So on the mm-hmm. one voice, we would do our regular voice. The second one, I would speed it up. So when you slowed it back down, it'd be a deeper voice. That's how I made our voices sound like crazy. And it worked out. Next thing you know, we put it out there and come up with flyers and posters, because that's what you needed back then. We didn't have the internet, so we had flyers and posters. Went everywhere with it, and it got word of mouth, and people were slapping it, and it just blew up from there on, and bigger things happened after that.
Man.
That's what it is. Hey, you know, with you guys coming together, see, what makes the difference between today's game and yesterday's game was everybody had their own unique style. Like, some would be more transparent, some be more straightforward, some be unorthodox, like ODB, or just some be just be the one to do the wild David Ruffin type shit. You know what I mean? Just be the one that be
that's
the character.
Perfect mix. Yeah. That's basically us. That's a perfect mix, because think about it. All the great groups, no one, the other person didn't sound like the other person. Andre 3000 don't sound like Big Boy. Run didn't sound like DMC. E-40 and Be Legit, a great match, because they don't sound nothing like each other.
Absolutely.
And that's how Doja Click was. Doja Click, I sounded like me. Nasty Trey had his name is Nasty Trey because he's a nasty motherfucker. So he would get on the mic like he was our old dirty. He was like our old dirty bastard, you know what I mean? And then Peabody was like our Nas, you know what I mean? And then Antidote was our, like, Souls of Mischief. And then I just gumbo mixed it. We did all kinds of shit, street shit, weed shit, fuck a bitch shit, you know what I mean? We had it, put it like that. We did every kind of style you can do. We did weed songs. We did drunk songs because we drank too, you know what I mean? Like the old English 800, you know what I mean? Did a song about it. Just whatever, you know what I mean? We was just like a group mixed of it just became like a gumbo mix of different styles, like you said.
Yeah, because, man, you have the leader. This is the part what I be seeing with a lot of groups then. Like, you know, with some groups, they'll come in, the leader, and the rest of the crew be sounding like, you know, weed carriers. You know what I mean? They don't have no superstar in them. They just want to, you know, sound like the weed carriers, or, you know, they rolling their blunt or carrying their bags. But you can tell those guys, they are along. They just want to be along for the ride.
Yeah.
Thinking about that time, that was, you know, it was always a particular era, because we, you know, groups have always been a thing in hip hop. The most important thing is making sure you have chemistry with the people that you're with. Sometimes, how have you all over the years, Ren, managed to maintain that bond, even through the ups and downs of the industry? And because we've seen situations over the years with groups where things were good and then all of a sudden things kind of got different. How have you all managed to maintain it over the years in terms of your relationships personally and professionally?
Shit. I guess the same with any other group. Yeah, all that kind of shit happened. but we all grew up with each other, too. That was the main part right there. We all are from the same soil, grew up with each other, and know all the same people, because Stockton, you know, it's not the biggest, not a big city, but it's not a small city neither, but everyone knows each other, so we all know each other, so we just barbecue, everyone to come over. I got a song, even if I'm solo right now, it's still Doja Click albums, because it's the same formula as me. They jump on a few songs, boom, drop the album. I just changed the name. That's what everyone do. Like, shit, it's basically the same shit. It's the same formula. Nothing changed.
Yeah. So
we just grown now. You know, everybody got kids. We can't click up like we used to. Plus, I live in Vegas now, so it's just as we got older, everyone, you know, like I said, got girlfriends, got married, kids, family. They can't leave like they used to. It's motherfuckers is going to soccer games and basketball, and, you know. I maintain because this is my fucking movement, and I still network, and I still, everyone comes to me for everything, so I still had to carry everything, and it don't stop with me. I make the beats, so I just keep going. I'm here now, shit. Everything's still cracking. I still got the fan base.
When you talk about in terms of making the beats and in terms of making it go, who are some of your musical influences in terms of the beats?
I would say Dr. Dre, Prince. I say Prince because people don't know he produced other people on the under as a different name.
Right.
Beatwise and Premier. Nowadays, maybe like Mike and Keys.
Shout out Mike and Keys, I don't know.
Actually, they're my neighbors. They live around the corner from me.
Shut up. Because I talked to Mike off and on.
There you go. Ask him about the liquor store in Vegas that he goes to. Then he'll remember.
Yeah,
we both
man.
Got the same
yo.
Liquor store we go to. That's crazy.
Yeah, man.
And Coolio used to live around the corner from me. Rest in peace, Coolio. If you're living in Vegas, you never know who lives around you. That's some crazy shit.
We got some people in Vegas. We're going to have to click you up off air with some of them out there.
Okay.
You know, we've definitely been blessed. We've been blessed to, you know, interview a lot of people and know a few people from Vegas and whatnot. Yeah, Mike and Keith, shout out to them. The marathon continues. They got something coming up for their album release party, The Paris Tapes. Y'all need to check that out.
Yeah.
Real solid guys. Real solid guys.
Check that out, definitely.
The second album you all did, how did you all get some of the, because they were starting out, like San Quentin, you know, Gucci, JT. Sugar was already probably the most established. How did that project come together in terms of getting them all on to guest on it?
All right, this is how that happened. Stockton at that time wasn't the city that everyone was looking in. There wasn't a fire there for everyone to see the smoke, you know what I mean? So I ended up going to the it was a rap convention called The Gavin back in 96.
Mm-hmm.
No, yeah, 96, 95, 96, somewhere around there. It had to be before 95 then because I had the Hard and the Grind album already. But I met Juice from San Francisco. I met him at the Gavin. We click up. That's how I ended up with Sam Quinn on the album and JT the bigger figure through Juice. Juice
okay,
basically
so,
opened up.
I always pronounce it Goosey, but it's Juice. Got you.
Yeah, it's Juice. Juice basically took me to his studio and hooked us up with a few beats with Les G. I started the kick on one of them, then I did the bass line and the kick on another one. But we did 209, 415, and we was basically the first group in our area to work with the Bay Area. You know what I mean? There was no one else working with each other. Cause back then, you couldn't hit up Too Short and be like, hey, let me get you on my album. He would have to listen to your shit first. Back then, artists wasn't just jumping on shit just like how they're doing now. It was like a bigger deal for them to just get on your album than it is now. Now, the shit's watered down. They jumping on everybody's shit. But back then, it wasn't like that. So we got San Quinn, Juice, JT the bigger figure. And when we put our shit out, we blended in with the Bay. That's why people think we're from the Bay. Because our album was out there with RBL. Totally insane. You know what I mean? We was in the record stores right next to them. That's why I think we took a step up after Hard in the Grind with Speed Kills because we got the Bay Area artists on our album.
Wow. I think that's some history a lot of people probably didn't know. That's why we love doing interviews like this. During that time, because you all are beginning to open up a whole new audience. Did you all know the significance of the impact that that album would have in helping you reach a whole new audience?
Which one? Speed Kills?
Yes, sir.
Oh yeah, that changed it up. Because our first album was more sinister. We're from Stockton, so we see all kinds of fucking grimy shit, and I was into like Brother Lynch, and I got to end up doing an album with Lynch later, but I was into that.
We're
shit.
Gonna talk
you know
about
I mean?
That
X-rated
too.
Brother, yeah, X-rated mm-hmm. Brother Lynch. I used to like that song from Ghetto Boys, Mind of a Lunatic, you know what I mean? So we was into the sinister shit because we was watching horror movies back then, Freddy Krueger, and, you know, it was different in the 90s, you know what I mean? Scary movies were a little better and shit, so we was just into that shit, and plus people were dying in our neighborhood, so it was just nothing but grimy shit we were around. So I based the first album on, like, more, you know, LSD and tripping out and, you know, dungeon shit. The second album was more street shit, and we threw a couple of dungeon songs in the mix, but it was more like street shit, you know what I mean? We was like, you know what, let's talk about East Stockton, and then we went to the Bay Area, and then we threw Juice on there. They talked about San Francisco, we talked about Stockton, you know what I mean? And got Sugar Tea on the album. We just switched it up because we were starting to do car shows and we needed some more up-tempo music. So that's why you see the switch up when I put Peabody in the album, Nasty Trey on the cover, and then Wizard, you know what I mean, from the first album, and then I just mixed it with a Black and Brown thing because I was like, you know what, we can do the car shows and we can do, you know, the Bay Area shit, that we can be part of that too. So that's, it was just something that I did. I changed the name spelling from DoeSiaClick because people couldn't pronounce it back then, and I switched to DoJaClick, and I did four letters each because I remember Run-DMC had three letters each and it stacked on top of each other without overlapping. So that was some marketing shit I did.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I mean, you...
And you working with Brother Lynch on... What was that creative energy like? Like what was that doing that album, doing that period was like?
Shit, we did it like the 90s. We was in the studio together. Basically, we didn't do the send the song to him and send it back to me. We was writing the hooks right there together. We was like coming up with the ideas right there together. So that's why I came out like, basically they say it's a classic now, so I'm gonna let the fans tell it. But shit, working with Lynch was like, I was like, damn, you know what I mean? We started our first album off that type of shit, and it came back around, and it was only right that me and him get together and do one. And that's like one of my best friends in life. We'd be on Call of Duty playing Madden, you know what I mean? So, that's the homie right there. Shout out,
man.
Brother Lynch, son.
Yeah, matter of fact, I remember it was an old Source magazine, 1994, February, with Ice Cube in it. And I want to say that was actually the first time I heard about Brother Lynch because they did a review for his album. And that was the first time I got familiar with Brother Lynch. You know, obviously... This is the early days. This is going back over almost 30 years ago. So, I mean, we just seen a legend of his. I mean, when we look at that whole horrorcore, you know, rap style, you mentioned, you know, X-Rated, Brother Lynch. Also, shout out to Lil Six, man. You know, if you're listening on the air, homie, thank you for the CDs, man. I got them in the mail. Thank you so much for the gift.
Yeah, that's a little homie right there.
Yeah, because I've seen on one of his joints.
Yeah, very supportive.
Yeah. Yes, always. We had a great time interviewing him. Great time.
Yeah.
How did you and him, and how did you end up on his compilation?
Oh, Lil Six.
Yes, sir.
Shit, I met him at when X-Rated first got out of the pen. X-Rated, like one day or 2 days after he was out, he did his video and. In Treasure Island, at a jail, out of all places. I'm like, yeah, this motherfucker gets out of jail and then does his video inside one. I wouldn't even want to see that motherfucker, but he wasn't even tripping. That's where I met Six at. But I knew about him before that already because of his dad and shit. You know, and I'm linked up with Lynch and X-Rated. So it was just something that happened, you know what I mean? And we connected a few times. He came out to Vegas. We went to X-Rated. He had a record release party at his studio. Chilled, you know what I mean? we did a song, but it didn't drop because I didn't use that beat. But I'm going to get them on some shit. We're going to work.
Okay. Now, shout out 24th Street Garden. For those that know, you know what it is. Block. What you said earlier really resonates with me. Because, you know, King and myself, we always talk off air about how some of these collaborations, how they have to be organic and how it has to come. That 90-0 was special, whether it was videos or whether it was albums. Because if you have somebody appear in your video that is major, or you have somebody on your album, that was because they really fucked it. You know, you just ain't had niggas dropping on your shit just because. Like, you really good. They had to respect you enough to get out there. When you look at music in general, because King talked about, he mentioned this earlier, from you as an artist perspective, how important is it for those features to make sense as opposed to just having a big name on the record?
It has to make sense because you have to, you got to mesh. If your music and their music ain't similar, it's not going to come out right, because then you'll have them out of their element or you'll be out of your element trying to catch them. And a lot of magazine reviews, they said that every feature that I put on my shit or, you know, got on, like even with the one I got, E-40, they was like, sounded like E-40 had to step up his bars a little bit because of me. And for them to say that, that's, I didn't say it. I wouldn't even ever say no shit like that. But for them to say that and put that publicized in a magazine means that, you know, I belong. So in a way, to me, having these features on my shit and for them to basically, you know what I mean, all the features I got, I can't afford no E-40 verse, you know what I mean? So I'll just put it like that. It's because of who I am already, you know what I mean? Lynch grew up listening to me. He told me this himself. So it's a shock to know that the people you listen to and grew up with, your legends, heard your shit. So that means I did my part. But to have the features and to be up there with your peers, it just shows that I belong. I don't know. That's how I looked at it. I didn't look at it like just get them on my album so I could promote it and try to push my shit because of them. I was already somebody, so I have albums with no features, and I got albums with features. I got albums that executive producers put out. I got albums I put out. So I've seen all the sides of the game. You know what I mean? I've done it.
And shout out Uncle 40, man. I'm a huge fan of 40.
People got to talk about this, but this month was also historic because it marks 25 years since he dropped Element of Surprise, which was indeed one of my favorite double albums.
Man, that shit was fire.
I mean, Hall of Gang. I mean, pretty much, Uncle 40, people got to understand, this man has released damn near 30 albums in a 30-year career. Next time you holler Uncle 40, tell him we're still mad at him because he hasn't dropped the book yet and he need to stop bullshitting. We need that damn
flight. Yeah,
that book going to go over people's heads, man. Just the slang alone.
Man. Yeah, we...
Hell yeah.
We need that book. When you first met 40, because by then, when you and him got together to work, 40 was already, like, established. How did that connection come about?
That's another one that tripped me out that knew who I was before we worked. He already knew who Doja Click was. He used to come to Stockton and do shows like at the Civic Auditorium and get on the radio and shout us out. And shout out to E-40, man. He a real, real, real one. You know what I mean? And like you said, you want your legends talking good about you. And other people moved out here that he knew. And he'd be like, are you out there with Ren? Ren's a solid dude. So hearing shit like that just solidifies where I'm supposed to be. You know what I mean? But I'm 40, a real one. And working with him was probably like one of my fucking bucket lists, you know what I mean? Just same with Brother Lynch. And like having these names next to me and, you know, knowing me and shit, it's just, I don't know, it's a good feeling. But, me and 40 matched up pretty good on the song we did, so I would say that shit, that was another successful single that I dropped.
one thing about it is, I mean, obviously, lyrically, you know, he wants some next level shit. And 40, you know, is on some, I was, you know, watching the behind the music that he did, you know, well, Unsung on BBC.
Yeah.
40 was just a phenom back then, and his didn't understand it until years later how lyrically gifted that whole crew is. You know, not just, you know, D-Legit, D-Shot, Sugar T, all of them. You know, they were way ahead of everybody else. And obviously, you know, you were bench pressing the genius of the grammar as well. I mean, so you all were basically going tit for tat. What were those writing sessions like?
Say it again?
What were those writing sessions like in terms of y'all bench pressing that genius?
I still couldn't hear you. You sounded muted a little bit.
I said, what was that writing session like with, you know, y'all bench pressing that genius of grammar, you know, in terms of getting the song together?
Oh shit, that one E40 sent his in, but it was to the my boys Hallway Productions. They did the beat, and then we sent it to 40, and then he sent it back with that fire ass verse. And then I'm a counter rapper, so as soon as I hear you and see what you say, I can go on there and flip my shit. You know what I mean? That's always been a counter rapper, so I just waited to see what he was going to say, and then I went on there and then dumped mine and shit. Same thing I did with Dub C. Dub C, when we did this, he was in the studio, actually. So Dub C came down, and me and Dub basically put the idea together, and then he wrote his verse. I was trying to write mine. I thought, you know what, let me take this home and listen to what Dub's saying, and I matched Dub on that one. So sometimes you just got to do that, you know what I mean? Be the counter MC. Same thing Biggie did with Bone Thugs. When he heard their shit, he's like, okay, hold on, I'm going to take this home and get in like y'all.
Yeah, that when we first heard, you know, rest in peace to Big, we first heard Life After Death, and we heard Notorious Thugs, because Bone had already been in the game 3 years from their first EP to their debut album. And I mean, but to hear Big get on that track, as crazy as that collaboration was, King and Ren, it fucking worked. Because we heard it and we were like, wow, like Big actually flipped Bone Thug style.
That's why he had to take it home.
Yeah,
said, let me take this home. I'm gonna come back and whip y'all up on your own shit.
Yeah, I mean, but he mashed on it. You know, that's something that, you know, when we look at Rest in Peace, Pac and Big, we look at how a different time was. We can say this on air because we know the story. We talk to people who were involved. We know people who were there. It was really a misunderstanding that really caused a lot of those issues. We're not going to get into it on air. You know, you and me can chop it off air about that, as well as King. Mm-hmm. But the streets are real. You and your crew, y'all grew up in it. And what we're seeing now today is we're seeing a lot of rappers embracing something of the street, talking shit, getting into some funk that they really, really, really don't understand what the implications are. Because I'm going to let you run with this, like Barry juking and scoring, you know, on your scholarly input. What was it like growing up out there on your block in Central? What did it mean to really have issues with somebody? And what is your feeling today in the game about how these artists are seemingly inviting their own demise with a dialogue, trying to be a whole? Go ahead.
Well, shit, back in my neighborhood, back in the day, it was Crips and Bloods, and they was really riding on each other. So if you was rolling with your homies who was Crippin', you go to the store. There was always somebody at the store, and they didn't know you. They would ask you where you from. It's a little bit different now, but back then you was getting pressed more. Now it's like, I think the music, they want to put that I do exactly what I do in the streets onto the music, and now you're seeing them getting rolled up off of that. They're getting themselves caught up doing that, you know what I mean? Because music back then was storytelling from the streets, but they weren't telling them what they were doing.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? They wasn't murdering somebody and then going and rapping about them and talking bad about their hood on the song. So, I don't know. I would just say that the difference now and then is more broadcasted on the social media than back then, how it was in the streets.
As you want, you guys got to compensate. They feel they have to compensate because the music ain't selling, the content ain't hitting, so they figure, okay, I got to prove I'm a Billy Badass.
Yeah. And that's where it goes wrong, and next thing you know, shit, their whole life is gone. And I don't know, I wouldn't say that they looking at it like a Tupac Biggie thing. I think it's a little different than that. I think it's like pressure from, you know, like I said, social media it magnifies everything 10 times, so that means the pressure of everything is 10 times.
Now,
they got everyone watching.
Right. Did you all have any issues when
who's gonna rob a store and go in their car and go live and showing their guns, talking about they robbed the store? Now, does that make sense?
No, it doesn't. Look, that gives about as much sense to Indian Red Boy going in there talking shit on Nipsey, and they wet his ass up in the car right then.
Yeah.
Once again, we can only say this because this was spoken about online, because supposedly he had to face Nipsey's mural. And, you know, he was a blood, but they slid on his ass. One, while he was on the live, mm-hmm. they slid and killed him on live. And it's like, dude, you know, it's like, why would you even do that? You know what I'm saying?
That's the difference, and that's the problem.
Yeah, it's a big problem, man, because they have to prove extra.
Yeah, that's what it is. People get their feelings hurt a lot more, too.
Yeah, because the online activity created that atmosphere for people to where they wear their feelings on their sleeve. Like, tell a nigga that his music game is really not that great. He ready to fight. He ready to shoot.
That's why I stay out of that. I get, you know how many DMs I get, people trying to let me hear their music. I'm like, I'm not gonna critique your music. I'm not gonna do it, because what if it's trash and you want the real from me? I'm not gonna lie to you, and then you're gonna be mad at me.
Exactly.
And yeah, you know, and that's one thing about it. We're blessed to do this show. And one thing about it is we hear a lot of stuff. One thing about it is we're never going to dump on anybody's dream, because we're living a dream doing what we do. But we also are children of this culture. We're men, we're journalists, and we take our job very seriously. And we see the proliferation of whackness in the game. And, you know, King, he, you know, deals with a lot more of the people than I do on that end, in terms of who will hit him about coming on the show or maybe sending him some music. And, you know, but the thing is, you know, we always are looking to interview people, but straight up, our criteria is just, you got to have some dope shit. That's all. Just have some dope shit and a great story. You know,
because dope sells itself, and that's what brings everyone in.
Exactly. You know, and when we see, there are two things that come in this game, because one part we talked about was the music, y'all. So the next part is podcasting, in terms of how everybody's trying to get into that and how it's kind of eroded it in terms of who comes in the game, maybe doesn't have a real interest other than just trying to get famous. Because same thing we're seeing with the music. We're seeing a lot of players get into the game who really don't understand what dope MCing is on the mic. They just want to be famous. This is your livelihood, Ren. This is how you made your living. This is how you fed your family. And you become a legend in the process. This is something you have completed all your assignments with this. From the broadcasting level, because this goes into magazines and everything else, how are you, how do you go about in terms of choosing the outlets of which you go on to talk about your history and everything involving the music industry? And how should artists, you know, take that same advice?
But like you said, the history. So I checked the history, and if you check the history and ain't a mystery, then it's good. So basically, I see who you interviewed, you know what I mean? And I'm like, oh, okay, they solid. They solid like Alloy. So, yeah, and then that's if you're up and coming one, and I see that you got a couple of under your belts, I'll check that out. And then if I see some numbers, I go with it, because you can help and they can help you. So it's like right now the way the game is, everybody need to help each other, but you got to be smart with it too. You know what I mean? It's all about angles, and you know, it's a different game because there's millions, like you said, just podcasts all over the place. So you got to just make sure you jump into the right ones and still get ads and you know what I mean, help sponsor even, you know what I mean. There's ways you can keep your name in there, because putting yourself out there in one podcast, they'll forget you the next morning, you know what I mean. You got to stay going to them, keep hip-hop alive, you know what I mean, because right now I see a lot of even newer artists saying it's trash. Now, if the newer artists are saying it's trash, there's a problem. There's only been one number one hip-hop album this year, and he's
right.
Not even the one I expected to be the one to do it.
Right. I mean, and that really kind of drives it home for us, because you, King, and myself, we've all followed each other for a second on IG. I remember a couple of years ago when, you and me clicked up on it, you know, so we all kind of followed each other since then. So when we got the chance, you know, to really reach out to you, I mean, Ren, we are grateful for this opportunity. We are very grateful to have you on the show.
Appreciate you having me on, man.
Yeah, and this don't mean we close the shop. Nah, nigga, we still going.
let's go.
Yeah, so, further into your history. So we're going into a little later on. When you decide to go ahead and start your label Heat Rock Records, what was the evolution behind that?
Well, I've been under a few labels and a couple executives. I figured it was time for me to create my own label and get to keep the name. Like I told you earlier, I did in Doja Records, and I let him use it. He put his name on it. But this time, see, that's being an artist, not knowing everything, you know what I mean? But now when you get older, you don't make the same mistake twice in music, because you're going to do the same thing again. So that's one thing I never did, was make the same mistake twice. And that's why I like talking to the youngsters, because I could tell them not to make that first mistake. But
Right.
I made my own label, and then now I know how to really do everything, and I have great marketing skills, and I kept the look, just like I tell everybody, if your album cover looks catchy and it looks like good, they're going to want to pick that album up. Like when I used to buy records in the store, CDs, I jumped to the ones that had the dopest cover, and then I turn it around and look at it and read the song titles, because the song title's catchy too, especially if you don't know the artist. Then you buy it, you know what I mean? Like, you know what, this might be dope. Look who he has on there. Just like I said, back then, having different artists on your shit, I looked for that, especially on the artists I didn't know. I'd be like, ooh, be legit, fuck with him, boo, I'm going to get that. You know what I mean? So
right.
You just got to have a good look. Yeah, you got to have a good marketing. You got to reinvent yourself every year. You can't be the same, because people get tired, especially nowadays. You could put a song out, that shit would get old in 1 week. They off to the next shit already. So you got to learn how to stay in a face market, you know what I mean, and do something that's shocking, because that's basically what the TikTok shit is, because they do stuff that – the what do you call that? The Well, Eminem has shock value. Yeah, what Lynch has, shock value. Lynch was talking about shit that shocked you. Eminem talked about shit, shocked. Lady Gaga, she dresses crazy, shock value. Prince shocked you. Michael Jackson shocked you. So if you have shock value too, that'll take you somewhere, because you got to do something to get people's attention, and then they grow up to it. Once they grow up to it and your song is a song that someone grew up to, it's good songs never die. You can use that shit forever.
Absolutely.
Good music is timeless.
And one thing about it, I mean, you obviously have that in abundance, Ren. Tell us about your debut, you know, Underground Melrose, when you decided to go ahead and, you know, really kind of strike out on your own with it, just kind of expressing yourself on the solo project.
Well, that was another challenge, too, to jump in back into the game as a different name. Because I was going to drop something after Steve Kills called Solo Operation. I started it, but then I just went and did something different. And I came up with the idea Underground Railroad. And what that means is the independent game. Because the independent game is the underground. So I flipped it like underground mail, like money road, the underground money road. That's the independent game. So I dropped that album, and that did very well because people knew who I was from Doja Click, because I put the name on there on the front. Featuring Doja Click, even though that's basically my shit. So I did that, marketed the same way back then, and it worked. It pushed all the CDs to the distributors, and since I learned something that time too, you could, as long as you put the name in there with it, like Doja Click, that's why I put that, it will link up into the catalogs next to it, so people knew, oh, that's the Young Ren from Doja Click, like the stores that don't know you, they're not fans. If they know the names that sell and they see next to Doja Click, it just clicked with it, you know what I mean? So it just ended up being successful the same way because, you know, you got to market. If you don't market right, you don't target your audience, you're not going to get anywhere. So that's another thing. You got to target your audience. Know your audience.
Now, one thing about it, Ren, is what you said is absolutely true, because you have to have the visual art. You have to have the song titles. When you all were looking at it in terms of how you actually, and even the album title, because I'm about to get to one of your joints, but when I saw that shit, I was like, yo, this shit is fucking bananas, and I love that goddamn title. It was Women, Cars, and Firearms. I was like,
yes, sir.
This is hard. I was like, that is hard.
That was the album that I never put out. After Hard on the Grind, it was like Hard on the Grind Part 2. I put it out through Rainbow Records back in the day. They pressed it, and it leaked all around the world as a bootleg. It got to Japan, Canada. People were like, hey, I ran into your underground album, Woman Carter. This was before the internet. I'm like, how the fuck did you hear that shit? I guess somebody leaked it from Rainbow Records out of L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And that shit ended up being around the world bootleg like I was Prince or something. So I was like, what the fuck? Like, how did everyone get this? I didn't understand it. So that people still hit me now. I dropped a tape of it recently, about a year ago. I put out tapes of that, but people want the CD, so I might have to do that soon. Or like the original. I mean, because there's hella like fake covers made for that shit. And in a way, I was like, you know what? I'm gonna keep it like a bootleg underground album, because I just like that feeling of that being that. But I'm gonna eventually drop the CD. It's got a different cover. It's on iTunes too, but it's a different cover.
Understood. How important was it when you all were doing projects to make sure that the visual representation was right? Because we see a lot of artists get lazy as hell in terms of the hustle, in terms of putting the money together to actually get a decent photographer, get a decent art director, all of that, because between your videos and your album covers, that's your job interview to the audience for them to rock with you. So you need to have something presentably that's dope. What was that like for you all then, and even now?
I always hooked up with like graffiti artists that turn graphic artists.
Because
they'll have your cover nice. You know what I mean? And then you in a way, it's your art, but you don't want to have a dusty ass cover neither, because people see that, then they look at you, they might not buy your album, and then they look, and some albums that had trash ass covers end up being like classic albums. But you still got to have the look. You still got to have the marketing. You just got to have, like, good people on your team. Like, you got to get top 10 people on your team. Like, you just – there's a lot of people in the industry. You see them and you see who they mess with. That's how you know they're good at their craft. You just got to watch people. And then after a while, just people started coming to me. And I picked the best out of all of them, like the best graphic. I had, like, if you look at all my covers, I had a lot of good graphic artists.
Mm-hmm. What do artists have to understand about in terms of making?
I knew the look. Mm-hmm. The look is what was good. Look at Run DMC when they came out. They got the look from Jam Master Jay. They went different from Grandmaster Flash wearing Parliament shit. You know what I mean? Looking like they came from space and shit. So these motherfuckers were like, you know, we're going to put the hats on with the feather. You know what I mean? We're gonna dress in some Adidas and shit, you know what I mean, with a white tee and come out with a blazer or something.
Right. What did you learn in terms of making sure that budget is set aside right? Because we see a lot of artists, they put all the money into trying to look good in terms of the clothes, but they don't put it into their marketing. They don't put it into hiring a staff. How important is it to make sure that you have all that money appropriated in the right places?
Well, before you start any project, you have to put your budget together and know where you're going to spend it, and you spend it in the places where you know you're going to get the most out of. Like, let's say... if you're going to do a Thizzler, you get an ad from them. You better get another ad from them instead of just getting one, because you do one, they forget about you the next week. Like I said, it's different now. So you got to stay in their face, because if they see you again, they're going to click in their head like, man, I seen him. He back with another one, and then you do him again. So you just got to put your money into the right areas that's going to benefit you, because some people don't. They'll spend all their money on a feature. And then they wonder why that feature didn't push, because you didn't have the money to push for the fucking ads. And you know what I mean? Like, you got to market yourself. Like I said, you got to target your audience. So when you get an ad on Facebook or something, they got this thing on there where you go to certain cities and you put certain tags of what you want to target. You target people with the shit that is about you. You target, like, let's say you do skateboard music. Then you're going to target and put a fucking hashtag skateboard. So your shit's going to pop up in that area. See, people don't think some people don't think like that. They just put shit out there and then they don't even think about to market themselves to a certain area of their music. They just think that they can go to any hip hop place and stand in line and hand out flyers and be like, dude, this is the wrong place for you. You can't go to an NWA show if you ain't doing NWA type music. You know what I mean? If you're doing like hip hop, and you go into there, they ain't gonna listen to that shit. You got to go to like Souls and Mission. And go network with that crowd and target your audience, whatever type of rap you do. There's a genre of rap for everybody, because rap is universal. Even though rap is its own genre, rap is a genre of all music.
Yep, and it encompasses so much. I mean, out in the Northern California, I mean, you know, all the people we mentioned earlier. Of course, you got Souls of Mischief and Delta Funky Homo Sapien, the whole Hieroglyphics, who shout out to them, you know, out of Oakland, you know, and I mean, of course, Domino, their producer. I mean, of course, you take it to the, you know, Oakland, you know, with Easki. You know, I mean, and of course, we can't forget Forax and Kenny Tweeter, the Mechanic. You know, I mean, all of them make specific music that everybody vibes to. You just have to know the audience of what you're trying to reach, and you know, who you know rocks with who. In terms of what you're seeing right now, Ren, who is coming up out there, Stockton, who has really, really, you know, made noise that you really fucked with? Personally, Muddy Boy Nail, MB Nail. I mean, I've heard about this youngin' for a few years now, and that boy has been killing it out there. What's it like to see that new generation come up?
Shit, I fuck with MB Nail. Haiti Babies came to me before. You know, I'm the OG, so they brought them to me like if that was Luke Skywalker and I'm Yoda. But I gave him some advice, you know what I mean, on what to look out for, because I knew he was gonna blow. So I was like, you're gonna have a lot of people like at you and pulling left and right. You're gonna lose some friends. You know, I told him the whole everything. So he even Instagrammed me back. Thanks for the knowledge, OG. You know what I mean? So I'm here. I'm here for him as long as, you know, they respect the OGs. We all good. Shit, that's the problem with the young, not the Stockton young crowd, but just the young rap crowd or rappers in general. They don't, I ain't seen one of them say happy hip hop 50th yet. So they need to go do what Mike Tyson used to do, go back and look at the greats and study. That way y'all don't sound like the same, because nowadays a style comes out, everyone sounds like that style, and that's what I don't like. Because back in my day, everyone didn't sound the same. You know what I mean? Shit. No one sounded the same. Everyone had their own shit. Scarface didn't sound like Ice Cube.
Yeah, and they rhymed. You know, they worked together. You know, Hand of a Dead Body. You know, and we look at it, though, we all come from a different era of the game. We're not the old men yelling off the hill, you know, just be saying we hate the new hip-hop. No, we love a lot of it. You know, a lot of young niggas coming in.
Not to cut you off, but just the other day, I said, man, I've seen hip-hop from the beginning till now. I've never disliked an era, but this era is different. It just ain't hitting. It's not because I'm old. I've been old. I was old when fucking Lil Wayne came out. So, you know what I mean? You can't tell me that I'm out of date or anything, because I've been with hip-hop for a long time. And even we have whack rappers in every genre. You know what I mean? We've had them. This is just the wackest. Good music is good music. I like Nipsey.
But, you know,
that was new. Mm-hmm. I like Kendrick Lamar. That was new. You just got to come with the shit.
Right. And it's wild because what's happened, I think, when we look at that whole situation is because of social media, it's expedited the process. We had Richie Rich on the show a couple years ago. He was talking about how in Oakland, you know, with the OGs and everything, that, you know, because you had a lot of OGs who were putting the money up for the young boys to get in. But their thing was, you were not getting in the studio unless you were repping the town right. You know, if you were whack, you were not getting in that studio to record nothing. They were not going to let you put that shit out and fuck up that town's reputation.
Yeah.
You know, so there was a grant, you know, not only through the industry, but it was through the veterans of the streets that you had to get their respect to do it. And what we're seeing now, Ren, is what we're seeing is a lot of these artists who are putting themselves on, which is fine. We're independent, you know, off the cuff. We're not backed by anybody major, so we do this ourselves. So we understand what it means to get out there and get it on your own, just like you did in your crew. But I think with some of the younger audience out there, I won't say audience because we're talking about artists, but I think with some of the younger artists out there, I think what's going on is they're beginning to get a little full of themselves, because in their mind, they feel like they're doing it themselves. Nobody put them on. And they're like, well, you know, I got this YouTube video up. Or, I mean, we're old enough to remember what it meant to get a video. Hell, we're old enough to remember what it meant just to get a record deal. To get an audition to try to get a record deal. You know,
we had a video.
Yeah,
man, it cost us $20,000 to do the video with Sugar T back in 97.
And that's
now 91. We got digital shit. Yeah, now we got the digital world. You can get a video for $400. Clear as fuck, HD.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, I think back in the day when Snoop Doggy Dogg did the What's My Name video, I think that was in the rap trivia. I want to say at the time, that was the first $1 million rap video. If I'm not mistaken, because, you know, that was the
CGI. You know what the first $1 million video was? Believe it or not, y'all.
Michael Jackson's
for rap.
Oh no! What was it?
Eazy-E's Neighborhood Sniper.
What? Oh shit! I didn't know that. Yo, King, give me the story behind that.
Yeah, me and Cocaine talking about that.
Okay.
Yeah, he said that they paid $1 million for it because you had to pay for the cops, the building, the scenery, the guns, all that stuff.
So this was a big production back then for Easy, rest in peace, when he did that.
Yeah, he was ahead of the curve on that. Then everybody else started following the blueprint to making like mini movies and hip hop.
Got you.
And after that came Murder Was the Case.
They all see what they was doing. They was watching each other.
Yeah. But I mean, even then, yeah. I mean, it was becoming a big production. I mean, and that was, you know, I mean, that video at the time, I mean, Snoop Dogg joined. I mean, you're talking about major. This is when we really started seeing, you know, artists and labels really putting up the major bread for it. You know, Ice-T, you know, shout Uncle Ice, who follows our page as well. You know, he was talking about when he did, you know, the High Road, you know, the I'm Your Pusher video. He's like, all that stuff in the video, that was theirs. You know, the cars, the jewelry, the coat, the gun, all that was theirs. You know, the house, you know, they came out of pocket for that. You know, but, I mean, you all doing 20 racks on a video rent in the 90s, that's serious. That ain't no play. That was, yeah.
Of course, y'all know. We talking 90s money. We talking 90s money in the million. Of course, you know, Puffy extra ass. He said, you know what, I'm going to do 2 million. I'm going to need fire.
Yeah.
I'm going to need rain. I'm going to be running through hurricanes. I'm going to be dancing through all that shit.
Yep,
nigga,
he did
1 million. I need 3.
Hype Williams.
Yeah, man. Yo, y'all. Kids today will never understand what that meant to see a little X or Hype video or Hype Williams in front of the video stand directed by either one of those two. I mean, this is back. Matter of fact, we saw the Mob Deep, Quiet Storm, because I think Hype Williams directed that. And, you know, that was based off of the Negotiator movie. Shout out to Samuel Jackson, you know, and Kevin Spacey who were in it. But, I mean, that video was based off of that. I mean, and that was like a big, big production when you saw that. You know, I mean, the art of the video was sacred. Rap City was our street light. We were home by 4:30 to watch Rap City. And we just saw...
me and my friend.
I mean, yeah. I mean, for you as an artist, Ren, what was it like just watching some of those old videos by some of those artists and how it inspired you in the videos you all did?
Man, my friend, if I missed the show, my friend would be like, I recorded it on VHS. Come over. I'd go over there, they roll a joint, next thing you know, we watching the same shit like 4 times in a row. It was that kind of feeling, you know what I mean? Like when Too Short came out and I had the white Too Short tape, we all gathered around that tape like a campfire. That one tape, people wanted to borrow the tape. Can I borrow your tape? No, but I'll dub it for you. I'll dub it for you.
The dub, they don't know nothing about the dub.
Man,
I was the dude in my neighborhood. I'd get the tape, and my friends would already have another tape to record over, or they'd be like, bring it over. As soon as they put it in there, they recording it as we listen to it. They getting that was their way of bootlegging it.
But yo,
that was
man.
That was the hood YouTube right there, the hood YouTube. They're going to get it. It's going to sound like shit, but they're going to bump it still.
I mean, but those are the memories, I think, that for all of us, we cherish. Because we were coming up right when computers were. I remember when we were in school and we got to go in the computer lab, and that was a big thing for us. Like, we had no idea what technology was.
The floppy disk.
I know y'all remember.
Yeah.
I know y'all remember Real Player. That was some bullshit.
Yep. Yep. I remember.
It had to take almost It used to take like 30 minutes down just to play one video.
Yeah, that shit is crazy.
I mean, before real somebody was before they was, yeah, I mean, that's before that they got the Wi-Fi technology developed. I mean, you had players like VLC player and a lot of other players that were developed over time. But the technology back then, y'all, was still, you know, it was primitive when we look at it by today's standards in terms of those advances. But one thing about it is, you know, we were actually outside. We were playing with our friends. You know, the computer was something we did, but it wasn't our life. And we lived our life outside of social media. You know, we interacted. We went out with our friends. You know, we were, you know, like you said, we would dub the music, videotapes. You know, we would pass it around, you know, because if it was some dope shit, we wanted everybody to hear it. And
that was, and
I know that's what it was like in y'all hood, you know. You know, y'all had some fire going on and y'all were spreading it, you know, like a wild. You know, everybody was trying to get to know who y'all were, you know. And how did that feel for you all, knowing that it was really, really becoming a thing? Like, you all were really making it, you know, I mean, in terms of, like, you know, did you all see the success, the legendary status that you all would end up having?
I didn't see it at the beginning, but I seen it once, like, I started going on tour, and like I said, I seen people singing our shit. But the first feeling that I got from doing music, it wasn't opening a CD. It was opening that tape and seeing side A and side B and your shit written on white on a clear tape, like a real fucking tape. That's when I seen that, that made me smile more than anything. I seen the tape. I opened the tape. I seen the smell of it, the crispiness of the paper, and reading the credits and shit. When we did that, the first tape, that's what got me. I was like, "Fool, I got a fucking tape out."
And I know that was a very, very proud moment for you. It's
in the 90s.
I mean, so in terms of what was it like in terms of your first overseas trip? Because you talked about some of your first shows in the States. What was it like going overseas?
Shit, I ain't went overseas yet, but I got many, many fans in overseas, and I've been invited to do shows overseas. I just ain't went. Even now, Germany, they want me out there bad, but we started a negotiation but didn't get nowhere, so. Because I'm like, I'm flying the fuck way and the fuck out of there. You better take care of me. You know what I mean? I'm not doing this.
It's business. Look, Ren, we totally get it. We get it.
Yeah, anyone who jumped on it, I'm doing the ice too on with it. And I'm like, no, I've got to make sense. I'm not going to just, because you guys are calling me, I'm going to be, oh, Germany hit me, I'm out. Shit. Better pay. I was like, I already know that I sold pretty good out there, and you're telling me I sold pretty. That you grew up in all the neighborhoods and all this shit. You even making it worse for yourself, telling me how many fans I got out there. So I'm like, well, let's get it right, and shit, and I'll go. So, I mean, he still got my number.
But look, we don't get in another man's pockets asking how much it costs to get you out there. You know, that's for you and the people you're negotiating.
We don't pocket dig over here. We don't
Nah, we're not doing that, but like you said, dog.
But business got to be right.
Right.
Business got to be right.
Yeah, I've been in it too long. I see, like I said, I made the first mistake. I'm not making it twice and shit. And trust me, I've done every mistake you do in the music industry once. You know what I mean? I've done it. The thought process, when I see everyone doing it, I try to tell them sometimes they're hard-headed and they're like, nah. I've had people tell me, let me get a beat and I'll get on your album because I'm going to blow up. I'll be on 106 and Park and this and that. I'm like, it ain't that easy, man. It sounds good, but them motherfuckers don't even rap anymore. So, and they got upset at me for keeping it real with them. But we're good. I'm just saying they was just upset about it. Like, I'm like, hold on, man. I said, it ain't that easy. I had to let them know. Like, you counting your chickens before you hatch. I said, you got to put in work. You ain't going to just end up there because you're dropping this album. Trying to get a free beat.
You know, and one thing about it too, Ren, you know, and King knows this as well, people we've talked to, there are rappers all over that are big in their area, but there is high school, which means you're in your neighborhood, college, yep, which means you're locally known, and then pro, when you actually are like out there outside of your state, in terms of like you're really traveling, and they're like Meek Mill said, you know, there's levels to this. And artists have to understand that there's a lot of rappers out there. It's like the NBA, it's like the NFL. You know, there's thousands of rappers all over this, you know, country of ours, this great United States of ours, that everybody is trying to get in. But there's out of roughly, just to give people understanding, out of 3,000 rappers randomly from everywhere, only 3 or 4 may actually really buzz.
Yeah. And there's so many from new towns that are going to make it. You can't really be like all of us are going to make it, because that's not true. It's always, like you said, about that many from each town that's going to pop, and they're going to really pop, you know what I mean? Just like how we got right now in our city. We got a good 4 solid ones. They popping and shit. Next thing you know, just like every other fucking city, once they wear out, it's going to be another next 4, and it just keeps going. But as long as they can keep passing the baton, I don't know. It's a different generation.
But it's also
pass them
too, yeah. But I mean, but I think also too, y'all, I think it also has to do with where, because one thing about it is, in these 50 years of this culture we love, we've seen how your hood can put you on. Like, we have artists, shout out G Perico, representing Broadway Gangster in South Central. You know, he just did a tour a couple months ago coming to New York City and performing. You know,
there you go.
And he's been doing this, you know, with his music and his albums for like 6, 7, 8 years. He's been doing this, you know, shout out to my man Mitchie Slick, you know, Linkin Park, San Diego,
yeah,
you know, The Wrong Kind, CJ, you know, Meek Face, Mob Boss, you know, Oso Ocean, that whole crew out there in the Southeast, man. And Mitchie's been doing it for a long, long time. You know, and while they may not necessarily be, if you're really into underground hip hop, you're going to know who those guys are. You know, but they've managed to really make a good living for themselves, you know, and you know, if you're dope and you really put on for your city is going to get behind you. You know, and you can eat off of that. And it helps you transition to everybody else. Because like you said earlier, good dope sells itself. If you are fly, if you are fresh, if, you know, you a fool with it, people going to fuck with you. But the biggest
thing
is they're
going to keep checking on you too.
Exactly. And you're going to have, and I'm going to throw in my own. When you got motherfuckers outside of your city that don't know who you are, well, I mean, they do know who you are, that you didn't even know you were reaching. Like, this is where the magazines come in. Because I've been in touch with those guys out in the Dago. And I first found out about Mitch 20 years ago, you know, going back to Triggeration Station, 20 plus. You know, and when I talked to his people, they're like, you know about us? I'm like, hell yeah, nigga, I know about y'all, and I fuck with y'all. They're like, Virginia fucks with us. So you never know who's going to find you.
Yeah.
You know? You know, but I tell
yeah,
you know, I think collective, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask this question to you. Because, you know, we read this and actually in one of my posts last week. Now,
right.
Were you really going to sign with Suge Knight?
It's not that I was really going to sign with him. I didn't get to that point, but I met him in Vegas before I lived here. This was during the Magic Convention. You know what that is? It's closing, big time closing convention called Magic. Mm. They were throwing, you know, they throw shows for that because a lot of rappers have, you know,
clothing lines and shit. It's everybody, country singers, fucking race car drivers, whatever. You know what I mean? It's clothing. Even Adidas, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Rockefeller. So we was at this industry party at a club. Shit, I just, you know, what's up, shit? I just hollered at him, and he was cool as fuck. It's a trip how, you know, we have known him as a mean dude or whatever, or bully or whatever. He was extra fucking nice. I bought him a drink. We talked, you know what I mean? Told him about some Northern Cali and shit. Took pictures with him and shit, and I gave him a fizz, and he fucked around and put a knife to his girl that night. You got to pull up the police picture, put it next to my picture. It's the same night this motherfucker went and did some crazy shit. But we were so cool. When I was leaving the club, this dude got up out of his VIP just to give me a hug, you know what I mean, and my DJ. He was like, man, good luck. He was super cool. So I was like, what the fuck, man? I mean, everybody's like scared of this motherfucker, but he was hella cool. But you never know. But from there on, I got a letter to the house, you know what I mean, Death Row Underground, because he was telling me he had a Death Row Underground, you know what I mean? And that's where we was going from there. But then after that, you know, he went to jail and shit. So nothing else ever happened. That Death Row fell apart. Death Row fell apart after that. So it's something that I could have pursued, let's just say that. I could have kept at it, but I wasn't fucking with it.
Understood. In terms of Vegas, how do you like, in terms of moving out there and living, how is it out there in terms of just the scenery and just, because it's the hell of rappers stay out there. We know a few of them. What is it like out there?
I've been around them. I can network better. There's more events for me to go around. Everyone basically knows me around here now. I know the cats that are here. I see them at all these little events. I'm connected, so it's close to LA too. So shit, I've been just networking like I usually. I used to come out here all the time anyways and network, and that's how I got a lot of my network in. But because when the Bay came out here, we all would be together. You know what I mean? I see Mr. Fab and I see Gary Archer, and next thing you know, we all in our little corner, chilling at the Gavin or something, you know what I mean, or magic conventions or the hip-hop conventions out here, and we'd all, the Bay would all click up, you know what I mean? I smoked my first cookies, and cookies was brand new. I smoked it in Vegas when my boy from the Gorilla Pits had it, Kalo, he had it, and he was like, man, come to my room, I got something for you, and it's that cookie shit right here. I'm like, cookies? First time, didn't even know, I didn't hit it in Vegas. And try to hear first. So it's just, I don't know. I love it out here. Everything is working out for me. So best place for me to work, especially. Yeah, shit. Best place for me to work. Plus, I see more of my fans out here because they didn't fly into Stockton. They come to Vegas to party. So I see a lot of fans out here. They spot me and shit. It's a trip. So it's even more, you think that I move out of town and be like, you know, not be spotted or whatever. Shit, I'm everywhere.
Yeah, it's more so especially nowadays, your networking skills got to be up to par, man, because closed mouths don't get fed.
Hell no. I'm from the 90s, too, so I know how to shoot it, and plus I have a good resume, so as soon as I get someone the flyer, or I have them scan my code thing, and it takes them to my page, and it shows them what I, you know, my resume of who I fuck with and shit. And I'd be like, shit, I'm out there with everybody, man. 40's my dude, Lynch. I got an album with him. Boom, it's over. Oh shit, this ain't no regular motherfucker coming to us, you know. This ain't no another rapper. This motherfucker's a legend. Oh shit, let's link up with him. That's how I've been networking, and it's working. So, you know what I mean? Motherfuckers go to my page and they see, oh, shit, this motherfucker, he got slaps. Oh, he works with Wooty Whoop, and oh, wow. You know what I mean? And they already know after that. They hit me up, and they like, man, I see who you fuck with. I could tell, woo, 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 and boom. Next thing you know, I get invited to another industry party out here. It's just, that's how it happens.
Yeah, man, because you got to let people know that it ain't about your followers, man. Sometimes when people see the people you clicked in with or work with, it changes their whole mindset.
Yeah, because they be like, oh, you one of them independent dudes, you know what I mean? We're like, cool, we've been getting this a long time, you know what I mean? JT the Bigger Figure era, you know what I mean? He was getting it from the independent game. He's still getting it. So there's people that still get it
like the 90s. It just ain't paying like the 90s because of the streaming.
Mm-hmm.
But if you still had a name from the 90s, you can still live off it, though. That's what I feel like the 90s was a blessing, because I still got the core fans, and if you got a cult following, it's a wrap. You can live off that forever. Cult following is what you want to get. You want people that grew up and have memories to your music. They got memories to it. It's a wrap, because that's never going away.
That's true. In this 50th year of hip-hop culture as we know it, Ren, how do you feel about the culture in general? What does it mean to you, and what does it mean to you to be a historical figure in it?
Shit, I feel like I'm right where I'm at, but I know I could have been even bigger than what I was. I think I did it the way I wanted it to, where I ain't too bothered by my fucking, because I like to be to my. I don't think I would want to be like how Eminem bothered all the time. I'm sure he hates the shit. I'm that
right.
Motherfucking. So I think I did it exactly to where I wanted, and I'm good. Shit, people call me a legend. I never named myself that, so I feel like I did my part in hip hop for sure, especially as an independent West Coast artist, where I got all my favorite West Coast artists to know who I am. Shit, that's and if I just did that, even I'm happy. Shit, I'm like, shit, I got the people I listen to listen to me. Put it like this: Dub C got on my album. I never even asked for him to get out on my album. I didn't go looking for him. He knew my the producers that were producing one of the songs on my album, Hallway Productions, who just produced C40's new song, The Bay. He hit me up. He said, "Man, check this out." Dub C was like, I'm trying to get on some albums out there, so what's up with the Doja Click? And I was like, man, he's working on my album right now. So that's how that happened.
Oh,
so
wow.
For shit like that to happen, and you know what I mean? And I feel like I did something, you know what I mean, for me not to even summon Dub C to come on my album. I wasn't thinking of him to get on my album. I'm not saying that I don't like him. I fucking love Dub C. Shit. I just didn't put it in my head like, oh, I got to get Dub C on this one, you know what I mean? He came to me with it, so that's a bigger blessing in the disguise right there. Like, man, shit, I got Dub on the album by him asking.
And that's when you know it's real. You know, we hear stories. You know, we've heard about artists trying to get people where money's involved, you know, or just whatever arrangements. But, you know, obviously money didn't come up in that conversation. He did it because he wanted to, and that's when it's the most genuine.
I just did a song with Baby Bash, and he didn't hit me with no charge. He was like, what's up, Rand? You a legend. Woo, woo, woo. Talked for a couple of years about it, then boom, it happened. It just happened. You don't ask for it. You just chill, just like with Lynch. I didn't ever think I was going to do an album with him. You know what I mean? We end up playing Madden together, become real good friends throughout the years. The next thing we do music. I didn't bring music up to him. I didn't be like, hey, we got to work. Because you don't do that with people that just want to be your friend. You know what I mean? He didn't ask about no music shit when we first started becoming friends. We were playing Madden, talking shit. And it became music eventually. You just don't fucking. That's why I tell a lot of people when they deal with me and other people, they expect certain shit. And I'm like, man, you shouldn't come that way. I wouldn't do that to you 40, you know what I mean? With the way people come at me with shit, and I'll be like, you can't just, like, I get a bunch of DMs of regular artists I don't even know trying to jump on my album. I'm like, how are you going to just, I don't even know you, and then you're going to hit me and be like, I should put you on my album. Like, you don't do that. You don't go in the studio and be like, hey, put me on that. I ain't going to be in the studio with you 40 and come, hey, put me on that. That's just something you don't do. So, I don't know. It's levels to the shit, like you said.
But that's something that you know where your place is, and there's nothing more gratifying than knowing that the time you put in, because we see situations where some artists, they become bitter because they didn't get where they wanted to, and, you know, you can put a lot into this game, and the worst feeling is knowing that you can put all you got into it, and it may not turn out the way you want it to. So we always want to concentrate on the more positive, the most positive, and the most pragmatic elements
of how this culture really enriches rather than erodes egos, you know, because at the end of the day, you know, the main thing is to have fun doing it. You know, it's a job, yeah. Yes, but enjoy what you're doing with the job. You know,
and if you're dope, it's gonna come to you. I always tell people that. If you're dope, it's gonna come to you. Someone's gonna come to you. They're gonna see the smoke from the fire that you started. You know what I mean? It's gonna go in the air, and someone's gonna be like, "Man, there goes a hot rapper over there." It's gonna come to you. You just gotta keep grinding. You know what I mean? And do it the right way, and not force yourself in. You can't force yourself into shit. It's not gonna work. The industry people, they get a bunch of yous all day hitting them with the same fucking questions or the same kind of spam, the same kind of the shit. They don't even fucking pay attention to that shit. They don't like that shit. Trust me.
That's true. In terms of who you haven't worked with in the industry, who would you still want to work with?
If I could still get a iTunes verse, I'll fuck with Q. My producers are around him. I got people around him. I fuck with Dove. I've been backstage with you, so I don't know. I'm just like I said, I'm not going to be on them like, "Hey, man, we need to work." I'm not, that ain't me. You just got to see you more. You got to see your face more, get to know a motherfucker, and he hears your music. You got to do it the right way. So maybe Q, already got one with E-40. I'll do another one, though. Corrupt. I'm out here with Corrupt in Vegas already. Like, I got a connection with him. Already been around him, but, you know, got to be around him more. Motherfuckers will see you're real once they get around you, and they be like, "Oh, that's the heat monster, man. He fuck with everybody." It's different than who this motherfucker that's coming around. You know what I mean? So you just gotta, I know how to network, and shit, you'll see upcoming, we'll see who I work with more. And when it's all done, there's gonna be a best of, and then there's gonna be a featured album with all the features I've ever done with. You know what I mean? So there's always gonna be something to put out in the market. Look out for all this shit.
Yeah, we're going to put that out. That collab is going to happen for sure.
Hell yeah.
So in terms of this documentary that you got moving, how far are you along with it so far?
Well, I'm writing the book first. Right now.
Okay, you're
going
with the book first.
I'm going to roll with the book first, and then we'll see what happens with it after that. And, I kind of got a little insight from fucking with Mac Maul. Mac Maul, he put out a book. I kind of asked him questions on how to do it and everything. So it's a slow process because I'm still doing music right now. So every time I jump into the book part, I feel like, don't do it. Don't rush it. Don't do the book when you can only do the book. So I got it like one chapter in. But I'm even working on writing a little movie too. You know, when cats from LA used to fly out to other towns and set up shop and sell dope and shit, and, you know, basically bring the LA scene to other cities. I started writing a book about that too. And I got an app, and I'm working on the script now, and it's looking fucking nice. And I got a personality too, so I'm like, my shit's hella funny. I throw like homie jokes in there, like some real. I've let a few people read it that wrote some shit. They said it's looking pretty fucking nice. So, but that's way ahead. So we'll get there. I got a lot of plans. I ain't leaving the game at all. I'm just gonna upgrade.
Okay, because we're gonna need copies of that book once it's done. So yeah.
we're storytelling too. That's another thing that I could put in my music. You know, I do horrorcore and all this shit, but I do also do storytelling, even with some of the horrorcore, because you got to tell a story like to do that. So a lot of people, what the rap game I think is missing now is story rap. Motherfuckers is just repeating chants and hooks and saying the same shit over and over, and then the fucking half of the verse is done because this motherfucker didn't write, but she just said same shit four times, and then now he switched up the words, and it's just some crazy shit, man. I don't know, that choppy flow.
Yeah, man.
But we need storytelling.
Yeah. I think
look at Q. Look at Ice Cube was a storyteller. You see what that did? It led to movies because he could tell stories so good. It was easy to transfer to movies. And when I'm writing the book in the movie, it's so much easier than rapping because I ain't got to come up with fucking rhyme schemes. I ain't got to come up with flow. I ain't got to come up with words to rhyme. What's going to make sense? Writing a movie, you're free with it. You can say whatever the fuck you want, and it don't have to come out in a fucking rhyme pattern. You know what I mean? It's harder. It's easier to just say some shit.
Man, look,
I'm a storyteller.
That's what it is. I still probably say my favorite storyteller of all time in hip hop has to be Kool G Rap, though. I mean, God knows. I mean, that dude.
Yeah.
He's my favorite
rapper of
all time.
I was just listening. Man, that fool was breaking it down on some shit, man. I was like, oh my God, listen to what he's saying on Road to Riches and how he's doing his words and his patterns and shit. He was gassing in 1988.
Man, look.
Yeah, that was dope to see Kool G get his appreciation. You know, big shout out to Nas for putting him out there to perform at Yankee Stadium a couple weeks back.
Yep.
That was a beautiful look right there.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, and the funny thing is, y'all, too, I think in terms of Fast Life, I want to say that's the first time in all those years that they actually performed that song live.
Oh, wow.
You know, yeah, I mean, I remember when I got 4, 5, 6 back in 1995, and, you know, Nas was only about 4 years in, you know, of course, from, you know, third base, you know, back to the grill again, so Nas was still 4 years in. And, you know, but he was still, but he, you know, Illmatic dropped the year before 94, and he was, then we find out, look, dude, not only is he on Kool G Rap's album, this dude is on the album cover with him. I mean, we saw that, and we were like, whoa! I mean, two icons of the game, G-Rap, John Connor. You know, shout out to the legend from Corona, and of course Nas, the kid from QB. I mean, that was just, like King said, that was just unbelievable to see those two legends together. We have loved every second of this. We thank you for your time, your history, your friendship, your humor, and your insight. You're welcome back anytime. Tell everybody where to find you. Anybody want to shout out, shout them out.
Shit, you can find me on all the social media at HeatMonster209. And it's HEATMONSTA, not Monster. It's Monster. HeatMonster209. Mm-hmm. And you'll find me. And from there on, shit, you can just keep building and, you know, listen to the old shit, listen to the new shit, see the difference of styles of music we do. You know what I mean? It ain't just one style. You can get some mob shit one day, then you get some different shit the next day. Depends on what the mood is. So yeah, we got a different flavor. So go peep out some Doja Clay, peep out some Young Ram, Ram the Heat Monster. You know, I got so many names and shit. But yeah, shit, tap in. You still here and shit. You know what I mean? I ain't gonna disappear until everybody disappears from me. And so far, they still here. So we gonna keep going.
Look.
Definitely appreciate it, man.
Absolutely. And look, you from the central where it's the P, but we don't mean P Valley, but we do mean paid in the valley. You know what I'm saying? So you've been doing it for a long time, man. And look, God bless. Thank you so much. Keep being legendary. Keep making history. You know we're going to be in touch off air as well. I'm going to hit you after the show because I got to... You know, we got chopped up about some of the people that you know that need to holler at out in Vegas and whatnot, and maybe y'all can do some work.
There it is.
Thank you again. King, take us out of here.
Man,
yeah, big
shout out to y'all.
Man.
I appreciate y'all having me, man. Shit. Love the show, shit, and it's a long one, so they get a lot of info on this one, so go ahead, we're going to tap them in and get them the replay, the instant replay. All
absolutely.
No,
absolutely.
Yeah, we on that note, we about to be up out of here, catch us same time next week. Whoever want to sign up and do interviews with us, just hit me up on the line at kingeric276@gmail.com. Follow us on Instagram at Off the Cuff Radio. Hit us on the YouTube on Off the Cuff Radio. We everywhere. So y'all have a blessed night.
Absolutely.
Off the cuff.
And we're out. Yep. E1.
We out.